Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the climate wars, the scenarios we are facing, and our options as a humanity. Then on the Scholar Circle, the long-term effects of bullying on victims, bullies, and society itself. Our options as a humanity may be dwindling in the face of climate change, says our next guest. The coming changes may completely alter the world as we know it, with collapsed ecosystems, mass immigration of climate refugees, and more devastating wars over basic necessities such as food and water. Gwen Dyer is a journalist, columnist, author, broadcaster, and lecturer on international affairs for more than 20 years. He's the author of numerous books, including War Future, Tents and the Mess They Made, as well as his most recent book, Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats. First of all, let's start with what you say may be actually better off. You're saying Scandinavia is a little better off in some ways. Russia might be, Canada might be, Britain might be. They're the winners potentially, but the losers are the South, China. Why?
Well, the closer you are to the equator, the more trouble you're in a warming world. Essentially, the trouble is food. The major impact of warming on human populations is going to be that it cuts into the food supply quite seriously. But that doesn't happen equally all over the planet. The further away you are from the equator, until you get right up in the high north where they don't grow food anyway, but the further away you are from the equator, the less pronounced the warming and the less the impact on foods of production. So even most of the United States can expect to go on producing food in much the way it does now, though not the southern bits, because the southern bits of the U.S. are actually in the subtropics. People don't realize that, but that's what they are. And the subtropics get hit very hard by this. Essentially, they dry out. They're already very dry, but they suffer a great loss of rainfall. And, you know, basically, without rain, you can't grow crops. So we're looking at places like southwestern U.S., Mexico, Central America, both sides of the Mediterranean, the north side, you know, Spain and Italy and so on, as well as the south, right across the Middle East, Turkey, Iran, places like that. Same story in the southern hemisphere. Most of Australia is in the subtropics, except the very southern fringe of it. Southern Africa, these are places that dry out and can no longer produce a lot of food, which, of course, is kind of non-negotiable. You either eat or die. And so your first impact is on populations that simply can't feed themselves anymore. The further away you are from the equator, the less you are hit by that sort of thing. If you live, say north of the Great Lakes in North America, or even on the south side of the Great Lakes, you're far enough away that you're probably okay until we hit, 2 or 3 degrees of higher average global temperature, which is a good 20 or 30 years away. So it's very much positional. It depends on where you are, how bad this hurts. Major problem that the soldiers see, and I've talked to a lot of soldiers about this, the soldiers see this as a process that's going to produce a lot of refugees. Refugees who are trying to get out of where they are, like Mexico, and up to somewhere where there's still food, or at least jobs that you can buy food with, like the United States. Same coming out of North Africa and the Middle East into Europe, coming out of China up into Russia, coming down from the Philippines and Indonesia into Australia, things like that. And, of course, borders being closed against them. And the dirty little secret is you can only really close a border if you're willing to kill people who try to cross it. So, you know, the world gets a lot uglier. Failed states, governments that can't feed their own people, do not survive on the whole. What's the use of them if they can't even do that basic? That's job one. So failed states, which are pretty ugly things, if you think about Somalia times 20, and in some cases wars. Wars between countries especially that have to share the same river system. Because when the going gets rough and there isn't enough rain to go around, the country that's upstream on the river is severely tempted to just hang on to the water and feed its own people and let the downstream country go hang. Downstream country has no recourse except war. So Nile River, Tigris and Euphrates, the Ganges, the Indus River, Mekong, all those rivers are places that wars could happen between the upstream and the downstream states when things get bad, because they probably will. And over the next 10 or 20 years, we can determine the outcome to the extent that it can either be very, very bad or only bad in terms of what the next generation's got to go through, but some of this stuff is going to happen. It's a bit too late to have no bad consequences.
It seems that it also is not necessarily going to follow a very particular pattern. For example, Russia was faced with huge droughts and wildfires, as was Australia, and these are very different parts of the world.
When you have a warming world, what you've got is a more energetic climate. Okay, there's more energy in the system, which means more extremes both of heat and of cold, which is why you get extreme winters as well as extreme summers nowadays. And it's also highly unpredictable as weather. I mean, you can say about climate or about the average global temperature, it's going up by 2 degrees in the next 30 years, let's say. But you can't say what the weather's going to be next week. And in fact, it's harder now to say what the weather will be next week than before, because extreme events in both directions are quite possible. And just to add a further degree of complication, you cannot actually assume that warming will take a gradual, predictable, incremental path. You know, we'll get 1/10 of a degree of warming every 2 years, and, you know, and then in 30 years we'll have a big problem. It can lurch. Which means that you could suddenly it's half a degree warmer all over the planet, which, although it doesn't sound like much, is actually a lot. It would hit crops very hard. I mean, one of the scientists, a guy called John Holdren, who's now the chief scientific advisor to Mr. Obama, said to me a couple of years ago, when you're talking about global temperature, you ought to think about it not like, is this a nice day or a slightly nicer day? You ought to think about it like the temperature of the human body, you know? And 98.6 is fine, and 100 isn't a lot more than 98.6, but you got a fever. It could get quite ugly all of a sudden. This is by no means guaranteed, but you can't discount the possibility. Which is, by the way, I think, why the energy secretary, Stephen Chu, came out with this extraordinary idea. He said, look, we know this stuff can lurch, and it's entirely possible that we would suddenly be faced worldwide with a sudden rise of a degree. And I'm talking a degree Celsius, so, you know, a degree and a half or more than 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in average global temperature, and crops would start to fail all over the world, and there'd be mass famines, and bad things would happen to good people. So what could we do to get the warming down by a degree in a hurry? And he said, well, we've done the numbers. In fact, I know the guy who crunched the numbers. He's called Dennis Bushnell. He's the chief scientist at NASA's Langley facility. And if you just painted all the roads and roofs in the world white, you could lower average global temperature by 1 degree Celsius, because it would reflect enough sunlight to lower the temperature at the surface. We have a lot of roads. That's the sort of thing you want to have in your back pocket in case suddenly the system really surprised, paying attention to as well.
You mentioned early in the book that you thought that the collective efforts of individuals really would barely dent the problem.
Well, if you mean by our collective efforts, light bulbs and driving less, yeah, I'm afraid so. It's not that it's useless, it just isn't the solution. It's a way of winning time in order to get to the solution, but the solution is stop burning fossil fuels, and there's no other solution. Saving energy, as long as your energy is still being generated by fossil fuels, simply postpones the evil day when you put so much of this stuff in the atmosphere you get into runaway warming. And that evil day is generally defined as when we hit about 2 degrees of warming, average global temperature, because at that point we lose control. Natural sources of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases kick in. The permafrost starts to melt and releases enormous amounts of this stuff. You can't turn the permafrost off. You can stop burning fossil fuels yourself, but if you get to the point where the permafrost starts emitting, you finish. You can't refreeze that. Same with the oceans. You warm the oceans and they go. Warmer water can contain less dissolved gas. They've got a lot of carbon dioxide in them, and if you make them warm, they're going to give some of it back to the atmosphere. It's like, you know, warm beer goes flat, so do warm oceans. Just conserving energies, provided that you're still basically providing your energy with fossil fuels, only postpones the evil day.
You've talked about some of the solutions that are being explored now. Worst case scenarios, we look at geoengineering types of things, although what we're doing now is already a form of geoengineering. Why don't you walk us through what seems to be feasible?
Your solution in the long run is stop burning fossil fuels. But the problem is that it's really hard to turn this civilization on a dime. It's like a super tanker. You can't do a tight turn at the corner. It takes a long time to turn the damn thing around. Are we going to run out of space? Are we going to hit that 2 degrees and unleash runaway warming before we actually get our emissions under control? And most of the people I know think the answer is yes. If you look at the way the politics goes, the United States doesn't even have any commitment to cut its emissions. Mr. Obama can say what he wants, but Congress won't pass it. Most countries have got a commitment to cut their commitments, but it's not nearly big enough to stop us short of the 2 degrees. And you look at those big international conferences and you do not feel inspired. Most of the scientists I've talked to, and actually most of the soldiers I've talked to, think that we are actually going to go past the point where you would normally get runaway warming. And here we have to do something slightly scientific, which is stop saying 2 degrees and talk about the actual amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that would give you 2 degrees. And that is 450 parts per million. We are now at 390 parts per million, so we aren't that far away. And 450 gives you 2 degrees. There is, by the way, signed up to over the last year, virtual consensus globally. Almost all the governments on the planet have committed to keeping us under 2 degrees higher average global temperature. The U.S. has accepted it, Russians, Chinese, everybody. If you're going to go through 450 parts per million, are you doomed to hit the 2 degrees that would normally give you, and into runaway, and good night, nurse, you know? And the answer is not necessarily, because there are ways that you could actually hold the heat down, even if the parts per million go past 450. Intervene artificially in the climate system to hold the heat down by reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches the planet's surface, and so you win yourself some more time to deal with your emissions and may take you another generation, but in the meantime, we don't get runaway warming, because if you don't go through 2 degrees, the permafrost doesn't melt, the oceans don't warm, these natural processes don't kick in and add to the warming, the ones that you can't turn off. So, you know, can we somehow divorce that 2 degree target, which we must not pass, from the 450 parts per million that we probably are going to pass through? The answer is geoengineering. Geoengineering is ways of uncoupling 2 degrees you mustn't cross from 450 parts per million you probably will cross, simply by holding the temperature down. And it's absolutely taboo for scientists to talk about geoengineering, even 2 or 3 years ago. You could lose all your status in the scientific community. Nobody did talk to you. People had nervous breakdowns from the flack they got when they opened their mouths on this issue, because the scientists reckon, and you can't really say that they were completely off base there, that if you tell the public there are ways to hold the heat down, the public, of course, being simple-minded darlings, will get the wrong end of the stick and go, oh, well, look, why don't we just hold the heat down and skip all this hard business of cutting our emissions? And the answer is no. To do that by geoengineering. Now the scientists are so scared that they're talking about it in public. The one that actually has got the most traction is an idea put out by a guy called Paul Crutzen. He got the Nobel Prize for his work on the ozone hole. And he said, look, we're going to go through 450 parts per million. We mustn't go through 2 degrees. How do we separate these things? I propose that we copy what big volcanoes do, because when a big volcano explodes, it will push a lot of gas up into the stratosphere. And the gas that the volcanoes tend to put out in huge quantities is sulfur dioxide, which, when it gets up there in the sunlight with, you know, little droplets of water around, combines with them to form tiny droplets of sulfuric acid, which will reflect sunlight. They do reflect enough sunlight after a big volcano blows to cut the amount of sunlight reaching the surface and lower the temperature. The last big volcano that blew was the Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. And for 2 years after that, we had an average global temperature 0.5 degrees Celsius, almost 1 degree Fahrenheit lower, thanks to the sulfuric acid in the stratosphere. There are still some questions. You wouldn't want to do this globally right now. You'd want to do small tests to make sure there's not really ugly side effects you haven't thought of.
Wouldn't it be far more feasible and less expensive to actually build these wind turbines all over windy areas and set up the...
Of course it would. You're absolutely right. But do you really think it's going to happen? And if not, where's your fallback position?
Let's think about this for a moment just pragmatically. Because if the financial end of it, because that seems to be the argument against developing the infrastructures and the capacities. And so when we look at it and we go, geez, it just seems like these geoengineering ideas really pale in comparison to doing the very pragmatic things.
They'll happen eventually, but we're going to come up a day late and a dollar short, as human beings often do when faced with a big problem. We'll get there in the end, but the end will be a bit too late. Nobody plans to geoengineer until we're there. But, you know, if it is 2030 and we're at 450 parts per million and it is absolutely clear, though we've moved over a lot to renewables, that we're going to hit 500 parts per million before we get the thing stopped, what do? You know, and the answer is you geoengineer, because that's the last option you've got left. And if we do the miracle, I think it's a political miracle, because not, I mean, you could do this. It's not even very hard or very expensive, but the politics is a killer. And if you get the politics right and you get all those renewables built and you're not burning fossil fuels anymore, nobody is going to want to geoengineer. But I look at the world as it is and I say to myself, this probably isn't going to happen in time. And this is the sort of answer I also get back from the scientists and the soldiers, all of whom want it to happen in time.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the climate wars, the scenarios we are facing, and our options as a humanity. Stay tuned. Look at a couple of things that you mentioned in this book. One is we look at the actual issue of climate change and the potential solutions and the very emotional responses that happen, especially from conservatives, for example, when you talk about regulation. And you cited this sociologist, Donald Brahman. Can you talk a little bit about his findings and how we might apply that?
I thought it was very interesting. He's a professor at George Washington University. What he did was he got a number of people who were self-described as conservatives, and when you sort of gave them a couple of questionnaires to answer, they clearly came up, you know, all nines for conservative. And he gave half of them a description of the problem of climate change and a proposed solution which involved a great deal of government intervention and regulation and even compulsion. And of course, they hated it. And furthermore, they didn't believe that climate change was a problem. This is not necessary. Government shouldn't be doing this. It's not a problem anyway. And if it is a problem, it's a natural problem not caused by us. This is nonsense. You give the other group of conservatives the same description of what the climate problem is, but now you offer them instead a set of solutions that involve unleashing private enterprise, investing in nuclear power, a full-on technological solution, which is largely in private hands. And they love it. And not only do they love it, but now they believe the climate science. It folds into how they think the world should work. He did this with liberals, too, and they were just as predictable.
What would be interesting then, and you mentioned also in your book that there are all of these enterprises exploring various types of alternatives, even ExxonMobil, which was the chief campaigner against the science, against climate science. And now you say they're pouring money into the these new potential technologies like algae biofuel for airlines.
Oh, yeah, $600 million over 5 years. which is, you know, serious money even for ExxonMobil, more than $500 million, to develop a source of liquid fuel that you could use in cars, use in aircraft, so on, which is carbon neutral. When you burn it, sure, it puts carbon in the air, but it's only the carbon you took out of the air when you grew the plants that you take the fuel from. And the plant in question is actually pond scum. It's algae. The beauty of this compared to, you know, like growing corn, which is now taking up about a quarter of the good agricultural land in the United States, not to feed people or even to feed animals, but to provide us with ethanol, which is a crazy use of agricultural land. If you're doing it with algae, well, you don't need to use land, actually. I mean, agricultural land, you know, open ponds will do it, or you can grow the stuff in vats. Your only inputs are sunlight and carbon dioxide. The water you use can be wastewater or even salt water, so you're not using valuable agricultural water. And when you've grown this stuff, and it'll double its mass every 24 hours, you crush it. And out of the algae, depending on which strain you're using, you get somewhere between one-third and two-thirds of the mass is actually oil. And it's, you know, it's a vegetable oil, but if you can push it through an ordinary refinery and crack it, and you get gas off the top, diesel in the middle, bunker at the bottom, all of which will go through the existing distribution systems and will run existing engines. You don't have to change the whole system. So that's the kind of solution ExxonMobil is working on. A lot of other people are too. They finally realized that they're not oil companies, they're energy companies. And we're not going to give up our cars, but we do have to stop burning fossil fuel in them. So if you can get ahead of the pack and come up with a fuel that'll run these cars and is carbon neutral, you just assured yourself two generations of market leadership.
So when you point out that the largest funder of the denial campaign, ExxonMobil, is actually trying to develop this new technology, and in the same breath, you also wrote about these other consortiums, for example, Desertec, which is designed a plan to power 15% of Europe through solar power in the desert. And then there are the efforts for geothermal and the wind. I mean, does that give you any hope that we aren't going to have to geoengineer and that we aren't going to have to build new nuclear power plants?
a little bit, but I mean, the task is immense and the timelines aren't good. I mean, we wasted the last decade. It'd be a lot more optimistic if we'd been working away at this over the last decade, but by and large, we weren't, although we understood by then what the problem was. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I think we'll get away with this. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, I don't.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about, for example, Desertec and these kinds of things that are being developed?
Well, this is a proposal which is actually, it's more than a proposal. There's now a contract signed, a whole consortium of really big European energy companies who are making a deal with the countries of North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, so on. The idea is, you know, they've got 98% of their territory's desert. And it's the Sahara Desert, which is a fairly sunny place, as they say. So why don't you use that vast expanse of desert with very energetic sunshine, put in your solar arrays, you know, the sort of the little cells that collect the electricity from sunlight, and then there's not much market for it in Algeria, which doesn't have a huge power demand, but run a cable under the Mediterranean Sea and plug it in at the other end to the European energy grid. Now you're cooking, because there's a market. And why would the Algerians do this? Because they depend on selling oil now, but they know, A, that oil is going to become less and less popular, and if we get ahead of the problem, a lot of it will remain in the ground forever because we stop burning it, and even if not, they're going to run out of it. So here's an export that will go on giving into the generation after generation long-term future. Why wouldn't they do that? And in fact, they'd love to do it. So, I mean, there are this kind of these deals to be made, and people can make money at it. You know, the conservatives can rest easy. Private enterprise will do lots of this. In fact, most of it. But here's the thing. Why am I a pessimist about us getting all the way to there in time? It's this. We need a global deal in order to get this happening, because if any country starts investing in a big way in these technologies and spending the money and its trade rivals don't, then it's at a huge disadvantage. We are spending the money to fix the atmosphere for everybody, but nobody else is carrying their share of the load, and their products cost less than ours because we're spending that extra money. So you need a global deal where everybody puts their shoulder to the wheel, or nobody will. Why can't we make a global deal? Why do they keep meeting every December? Why can't they just say, okay, that's the problem, here's the solution, sign here? And the answer is that there's a real historical problem. And the historical problem is this: 80% of the greenhouse gases that are in the air now of human origin, the excess stuff that's causing the warming, was put there by a very small group of countries, of which the United States is one. You know, it's the old industrial countries, America, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Russia, Japan. We account for about 1/7 of the world's population. We put 80% of that stuff out there because we started putting it up there 2 centuries ago. We had our industrial revolution. We got rich because we were burning fossil fuels, and we've taken up almost all the space in the atmosphere that is available in terms of dumping extra carbon dioxide in there before you go past 450 parts per million and crash through the 2-degree barrier. So now all these other countries come along, China and India and Brazil and all the rest, who want to industrialize, who are now well on the way to doing it. But if they do it the way we did it, burning fossil fuels, we all go over the cliff together. So make a deal that somehow lets them go on growing their economies, but stops them from growing their emissions, because it's mainly them whose emissions are increasing now.
It would make sense for them to then develop the technology that would take us out of this mess.
Indeed, except they're still relatively poor countries. Right. So somebody's got to pay for that. And it probably isn't them. Actually, when you go to these big conferences, everybody knows what the deal is. I mean, it doesn't get signed, but everybody knows what it would look like if it were made. And it looks like this. The developed countries, because they are largely responsible for the fact that we're so near the edge now, take really big cuts up front. The numbers that were being kicked around 2 years ago in Copenhagen, 40% cuts in 10 years in our emissions, which is a big bite. Wouldn't be cheap, doable. You wouldn't have to mobilize like we did in the Second World War, but you definitely feel the pain. We take 40% cuts in 10 years. That sort of slows down the process and gives a little breathing space, and then we can do it a little bit less vigorously in the next decades, though we have to keep doing it. The developing countries don't take cuts. They cap their emissions where they are now. Don't expect them to take cuts. They're still poor. We're rich. We've been burning this stuff for 200 years. They've been burning it for 20. They still do per capita maybe a quarter of what we do per capita in terms of emissions. You mustn't expect them to take cuts. The most you can ask them is to cap their emissions where they are now. We'll take the cuts. And if they cap their emissions, that means they can't put any more fossil fuel sources of power in. They can't put any more coal-fired plants in. You know, their vehicles have to be fueled by something that isn't gasoline. Who pays the difference between the cheap and dirty coal-fired plant that China puts up every week now and the solar array, the wind farm, the nuclear plant, whatever it is that they put up instead once they sign that deal and agree not to increase their emissions? And the answer is we do. That's the deal. And it is fair, but it looks very lopsided. I mean, if any Western leader came home having signed that and said to the gathered nation, we've saved the planet, here's the deal, we're going to cut our emissions by 40%, the developing countries won't raise their emissions anymore, they're going to cap them, oh, and we're going to be shipping $100 billion collectively a year to them so that they can go on growing their economies without growing their emissions, you wouldn't survive a week in office. That's why the deal doesn't get done. It will get done eventually. We do have an ability to learn, but it may be a bit late, and that's why on Thursdays I'm a pessimist.
Well, Gwen Dyer, author of Climate Wars, The Fight for Survival as the World Overheats, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, Maria.
When we come back, long-term effects of bullying on individuals, groups, and societies. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Bullies and victims of bullies are much more likely to develop psychological disorders such as agoraphobia, panic disorder, suicidal thoughts, and aggressive behavior as adults, according to a recent study. In both adult and adolescent settings, bullying cultures can emerge when bystanders and others disengage and allow the behavior to continue, ultimately creating abusive organizations. What is the long-term effect on individuals and, by extension, on societies resulting from bullying behaviors? Three experts join us. Catherine Bradshaw is a professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and School of Education. She is the deputy director of the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. Her studies include bullies, gangs, drugs, and school, understanding the overlap and the role of ethnicity and urbanicity, risk factors for bullying among children with autism and spectrum disorder, and teachers and education support professionals' perspectives on bullying and prevention. Yana Yuvonen is a professor of developmental psychology at UCLA. She is the author of Peer Harassment in School, The Plight of the Vulnerable and Victimized, and The Rejected and the Bullied, Lessons About Social Misfits from Developmental Psychology. Joyce Heems is chair and professor in the Department of Management and Industrial Relations at West Virginia University. Her publications include A Bully as an Archetypal Destructive Leader and Bullying from the Playground to the Boardroom. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. What I'd like to start with is long-term effects that bullying has on individuals who might have been either bullied when they were younger or even maybe older, and maybe even the bullies themselves. Catherine Bradshaw, let's start with you. You've said it has a profound effect on mental health all the way into adulthood. What are the effects on individuals and maybe by extension societies?
Well, the research on bullying is relatively recent when it comes to long-term effects. There has been a lot of cross-sectional research documenting immediate impacts and kind of correlates, as we would often think of them, of bullying, and trying to understand what longer-term impacts there are has really only been a more recent development as our longitudinal data systems have become more available to track long-term impacts. But we have seen a range of mental health impacts, including internalizing problems, externalizing problems like aggression, even substance use problems. When you think about the school environment, there are also concerns as it relates to academic performance, school attendance, and academic engagement more broadly.
You have also written a bit about, using these longitudinal studies, how youth who have either been bullied or bullies themselves become perhaps later in life more aggressive, delinquent, and maybe even members of gangs. What have you found?
Yes, we're actually seeing a lot of overlap in some cases of the youth that are involved in bullying as both a victim and a perpetrator. Youth that are aggressive and involved in bullying as a victim as well as a perpetrator often struggle with issues around emotion regulation, challenges calming down when they're upset, really trying to understand how they can interact in a way to resolve conflict in a peaceful way.
Yana Yuvonen, let's bring you in. What are the findings that you have seen?
Well, one of the interesting issues to me as we're learning about these long-term effects is the question of why. Why do kids engage in bullying and why is it so incredibly detrimental? One way to think about these issues of why is that bullying may at times serve a function. So rather than thinking about there are mean kids and then there are their poor targets, maybe in part bullying reflects circumstances or situations. There's some evidence suggesting that bullying peaks, especially during transitional periods of time when, for example, kids are transitioning from elementary schools to middle schools. And what we are curious about is how much this sort of bullying that may be in part temporary rather than stable is a reflection of the need to create a status hierarchy that may serve a purpose during a time of transition where kids are not necessarily aligned with their friends yet, when they need to sort of create a structure of their own. So bullying may serve a function during certain times, and when it serves this function, it may be particularly difficult to intervene with because these bullies, as they strive to be dominant individuals in the status hierarchy, they get rewarded by the peers. That is, nobody challenges them. Nobody dares to challenge them because they are so powerful.
Joyce Heems, you've looked at it from organizational perspectives, but I thought maybe what we should do is look first at the psychology. You've talked about the natural target that victims tend to be. What is that natural target?
Well, there is some evidence to say that if someone tends to be shy, reserved, withdrawn in day-to-day, that they may be more of a natural target for bullying. And we have looked at this. In fact, we had an article that said from the playground to the boardroom, and that we were seeing that some degree of evidence that those who were bullies as a child would take that aggressive behavior into the workplace, and that as things are changing, as organizations are changing, increased in change. I know Ivana just said that, you know, there's more changes are coming at people, and especially at the adult level, that they don't know how to handle that. They don't know how to handle that aggression, and maybe they have some resistance to authority. And as things are changing in environments in which they are not comfortable in, they act out in such a way. And they look for those that will not speak up to them, will not stand up. One of the studies that we're looking at now is what we call the worker-to-worker transaction. So not just the abusive supervisor or that power differential between the employee and the supervisor, but if I see someone bullying you and we're all colleagues, why or when would I want to step in? And what we're seeing is people say, I'm not even going to step in as an observer of that because I'm afraid that bully will turn on me. And the victim doesn't want to report the bully because afraid the bully will get even more aggressive. So our culture is not set up in such a way. Companies are just now coming on board. As Catherine said, we don't have longitudinal studies yet that really shares what the long-term effects are going to be. But companies are finally getting on board to say, we're going to have a zero tolerance, and we want a respectful, healthy environment, is how they're phrasing this, and really trying to stay away from the terminology of bullying.
We've got a lot of mental disorders in this particular society in the U.S. Catherine Bradshaw, is there a relationship here?
We have documented through both short-term as well as long-term research that one's involvement in bullying is a risk factor for subsequent and concurrent behavioral and mental health concerns. And it's most pronounced among the youth that are involved as both a target as well as a perpetrator. While it is difficult, however, to tease out the cause versus the consequence, because often youth who are targeted might have internalizing problems, as the previous speaker referenced, or have other problems getting along well with others, and thus are marginalized either in the workplace or in the school environment. So this is really a complex phenomenon and often doesn't have very easy solutions. But if we think from a life course perspective that in childhood kids that are exposed to violence in the home or have challenges in their peer group and adopt an aggressive way of interacting with others or are reinforced, because sometimes that works, and that they might reach a higher dominance within their peer network, we can understand, and Jana commented on this, that sometimes that becomes adaptive for some kids. They can get rewarded. And we can very easily see similar extrapolations into the workplace as adults. Individuals that kind of bully others often are hoarding a lot of the resources and the power and the dominance within the work environment. And so that's why it's so important for us to keep in mind that these bullying activities, while we might be a little more comfortable calling them bullying among school-aged youth, and much of the research has taken that approach, there has been increasing interest in what does this really look like in the workplace, and what does this look like in college students or within adult populations. And we really have not seen very much research focused specifically at these issues in adulthood, which youth continue on and which forms of aggression. For example, people often stereotypically think about bullying as just being physical, when we know the vast majority of bullying acts are more relational in nature and social in nature. And it's my hypothesis that those are really the ones that continue across the life course, and that they can get played out in terms of workplace drama or emails and text messages that are carried on in the workplace for adults. So I think it's really important for us to keep in mind a life course perspective, that these behaviors don't just go away.
Absolutely. If I may pitch in, this is Jana. So I think that it's fascinating the way Joyce talks about the workplace bullying, because really, in the end, it's not only about individuals, those who try to dominate and those who are the easy or safe targets, but it's also about the atmosphere, about the climate. Mm-hmm. Catherine has done work, and we've done some work on how bullying affects the entire climate of a school. So obviously, when we're talking about bullying, one of its most detrimental effects, besides it having long-term consequences for both bullies and victims, is that it really affects the well-being of everyone in that setting. And we have some evidence based on just these kind of daily reports that we do with students in school that even just witnessing somebody else getting bullied elevates their levels of anxiety during that day. So we're talking about pervasive effects on large number of individuals in the setting where bullying takes place.
Let's then go to this idea of a bullying culture. All of you have touched on this a little bit. And Jana, I think in one of your pieces, you talked about how popular and dominant bullies control the peer norms. Joyce Heems, I think that this is something that you've also written about in the more organizational and workplace settings. I'm a political scientist, so I, of course, wonder about how this gets carried on into the political settings like Congress, where we see some of this going on now. But when you have bullies as popular cultural leaders and political leaders, what happens to the societies? Joyce, you should start us on that.
Sure, absolutely. First, let me say that I would like to clarify, and we talked about this briefly, and I believe Catherine alluded to this, there is a distinction between what we would determine as workplace bullying and harassment or some other forms of aggressive behavior. And workplace bullying typically is more psychological than it is physical. It is more covert than it is overt. And it's the motivation behind it is not a prejudice or a bias typically. In fact, we found that bullying doesn't have a lot of biases. It's more about something you have that I want. So there's a greed or a jealousy or something along those lines. So I think that's a nice distinction to make in terms of what we're really talking about. But in one of the pieces that we did, more to your point, Maria, is that we talked about the social-emotional contagion theory and how that in the workplace people will often, if you will, catch the emotions and behaviors of other people. So if, for instance, I'm in an environment and cursing is allowed, and it goes on and on and on, I get immune to it after a while. And I may say things that historically I might not have said otherwise. So our environments are very key to this. So if bullying is allowed or is not corrected, is not countered in some way, those around will say, hey, you know, Catherine got away with that, so I bet I can. And they'll take on those types of behaviors. And I think that that cultural issue is really prevalent in this conversation, because organizations have got to take on more directive action in controlling this and putting in the zero tolerance type of policies.
And if they're coming from the leadership itself, then that becomes a complicating factor, I would think.
Ben Tepper and a few of his colleagues, Ben's down at Georgia State, has done a lot about the abusive supervisor and how to control those and putting in mechanisms back in the 80s and 90s when we were talking about sexual harassment and training and raising that awareness, putting in mechanisms so people could feel comfortable in reporting. And they haven't done that yet, I think, society-wide or organizational across industries for people to report bullying. So it's not just my peer that's bullying me, but it's my boss. How can I go around that? And we've got to put in mechanisms very much like we did to counter the sexual harassment that we saw so prevalent back in the 80s and 90s.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, and we're talking about the effects of bullying behavior on individuals, groups, organizations, and societies. Catherine Bradshaw.
Yeah, I think your use of the term zero tolerance is one thing that's gotten a lot of attention and some concern in the literature. And most of that has started off looking in juvenile justice settings and adult criminal offenses, and then has been somewhat extrapolated into the school setting and saying, well, we're going to take a zero tolerance type of approach around school bullying. And what that typically means is anybody that's bullying gets an automatic suspension and sent out. And we've seen other examples of this, of really harsh types of punitive responses to bullying. And frankly, we've learned that that kind of zero tolerance in a more formal policy type of way is one that we don't see a lot of evidence actually working. But I think Joyce is kind of alluding to a more colloquial term of, we're not going to accept this, this isn't tolerable, not that somebody's immediately going to get fired or punished as a result of that. So I think we need to have these environments where people don't feel a threat of turning in someone else, or and understanding the difference between reporting and tattling, as I often hear with kids, is I don't want to be a snitch, I don't want to be the one that kind of outed that person. And so I think as we try to take some of these concepts in the K to grade 12 type of setting and think, well, what would they really look like in the workplace? And are there certain policies and procedures that we would use in one context versus the other? So just want to put that kind of caveat around the zero tolerance type of approach, and what does that really mean from a policy standpoint in the school setting relative to a workplace.
Jana Juvonen.
I think it's interesting to think about the social contagion perspective that Joyce brought up, that indeed we know also in classrooms and in school settings, once there is a kid who gets by and becomes even more popular by bullying other kids, that encourages other kids to engage in bullying as well. But in addition to that, you know, going back to the sort of how bullying affects the entire climate of a setting or a collective, is that often bullying is perceived, although it may be anxiety-provoking, people fear and are concerned about becoming the next targets. At the same time, what they actually do behaviorally looks like they enjoy it. They enjoy watching it. That is, bullying often in school settings can be entertaining or amusing. So when the bystanders react that way, even when deep inside they say, oh my gosh, this is not really okay, or I sure hope I'm not going to be the next target, when they laugh, when they smile, they are encouraging bullying. So we get into these kind of vicious cycles, and this is precisely what's so very difficult to try to stop, is that in spite of the sense of unsafety, anxiety, etc., the way we behaviorally convey our attitudes about bullying, they seem to be very encouraging of the bully and bullying behavior. So that's yet another way in which bullying becomes socially contagious.
Social psychologists have frequently talked about why bystanders behave in particular ways, role-playing or the mob kinds of behaviors or groupthink. If, in fact, people naturally shy away from being the one to call it out, is there some way of approaching this to stop the mob? How does this interplay with this issue of bystanders?
This is Joyce. And one of the things that we talked about and are looking at right now is their ability to intervene. And our research is showing that they don't feel comfortable. They don't. Their self-efficacy of their success in that is very low. So they're saying, you know, I don't know how. I don't know whether I'd be effective. Would I make it worse for that person? Would I make it worse for me? You know, I was struck a couple years ago. My son-in-law is an orthopedic surgeon, and he was talking about this lady that had a major accident, and I made the comment. I said, oh, my goodness, she'll never walk again. He said, no. He said, I can do this. I can fix that. I can mend this. In 6 months, I'll have her up and walking. And I thought, you know, his ability, his knowledge of how to fix that situation, his self-efficacy was out the roof, his confidence level in that particular task. We don't have that when we're talking about the emotional, psychological impact, and especially of something so severe as what we're terming here as bullying. It takes someone who really has, even with social identity, we looked at if I think a fellow female is being bullied, would I tend to step in quicker? And yes, the research is showing that we would if we identify with that person in some way, because we don't want them to be bullied. So I would step in quicker if it was a female than if it was a man. If it's a child, absolutely. Everyone tends to, you know, want to run to the rescue of a child. But their thought process is, if I step in, can I make it better? Will I make it worse for them and for me? So it's hard for them to know how. We did some experimental studies and looked at training, and it was very little increase in their willingness to step in, even though they had some degree of training in how to do that. Again, that takes a lot, and this takes a psychologist or someone who really would feel comfortable doing that.
Is there a pathology that develops? For example, do bullies become authoritarian personalities? Do they become antisocial? Given the degree of people behind bars now, is there a relationship that you think has developed from this? Catherine, I think this is something that you started to talk about.
At a basic level, we know that an early onset of aggressive and pretty serious disruptive behavior problems can be a risk factor for what is often referred to as a life course persistent pattern of aggressive behavior. There have been researchers that have been looking at this both within the U.S. and internationally to try to understand some of those early precursors of aggressive behavior across the life course. And some of those include executive functioning problems, so kids' brains just operate a little bit differently than others, have problems with impulse control, emotion regulation. And so while those studies have been focused more generally on the issue of aggressive behavior, trying to understand some of these long-term outcomes, bullying could be one of those behaviors, but it's very difficult to look at a broader set of aggressive behaviors and say, well, is this generalized to every kid that bullies or to every kid that's aggressive? Because we know some kids, you know, have a transition problem and thus they're vulnerable to experiencing difficulties and challenges, but through intervention they're able to get back on the right track or just kind of grow out of it, or in a peer context it's more supportive for one type of behavior over the other. So I think there is potential for aggressive behavior that has an early onset and is not intervened with effectively to lead to a more serious pattern of aggressive and problem behavior, and could lead to criminal activity as well as more serious psychopathology in adulthood. We see that tends to be highest among youth that are involved in bullying as both a target and as a perpetrator. And for example, one of our recent studies had shown that youth that were involved in bullying on both ends were much more likely to carry weapons and more likely to enter gangs. And so even taking gang activity as an example, I actually see some parallels between bullying and gang activity. For example, the power and status associated with aggression and aggressive behavior, dominance over others. Quite often there's a fear that you're going to be targeted by the gang if you don't become a member of the gang, and it's a very aggressive network and complex network around power that's drawing them together. So I see some similarities there on some basic levels. However, we have to be very, very cautious not to assume that every kid that engages in aggressive or bullying behavior is going to get on this life course persistent pathway, because there are some youth that engage in these behaviors and kind of trying them on, and they don't work out very well for them. They don't meet their need, be they social or instrumental, and perhaps also through effective intervention, we're able to get them off of that path. So frankly, the fact that we have, you know, let's say 18 to 20% of youth have been the victim of bullying, we don't have those extremely high rates of adult psychopathology. But if they're not addressed, it can cause problems in their adult relationships, their relationships with their significant others, or even be passed on to their children. So we have to be cautious. In fact, I gave a talk on bullying at a psychiatric hospital in upstate New York, and afterwards one of the physicians came up to me and said, I feel like you're pathologizing the issue of bullying. We have to remember that there are a lot of kids that find themselves in a situation either because other peers are doing it through this peer contagion process that was discussed, but they engage in that behavior. And if it's addressed early on and effectively, I think it can really pull them off of that more negative trajectory.
Pertaining to globalization, and Joyce Heems, this is something you wrote about, how globalization might be enhancing, for lack of a better word, a bullying culture. Can you describe what you mean by this?
Well, we're talking about the rapid rate of change and the complexity of the organizations as they're going global, and as you're putting more diverse people together and them trying to understand and their comfort level with that. I'd also like to take that and talk a little bit about what Catherine was talking about and recognize that both the bully and victims, as we see them, and just anyone in general, has different coping mechanisms and different abilities to cope. So a young person who was exposed to bullying, maybe even tried it on, realized it didn't fit, and their coping mechanisms are strong enough that they break the bonds from that. by the same token, you may have a victim that has very low self-esteem, and their ability, they turn something that is really not bullying, and in their mind it becomes bullying because they don't have sufficient coping mechanisms in place. And that may have come from the fact they had been exposed to it as a child or some others, so they just don't know how to respond to it. So when we talk about globalization, we're talking about different cultures, different ways of responding, different ways of coping, and having to, as managers, having to interpret those different societal issues that people are coming from. So it just creates a whole level of complexity by adding this globalization to the workplace.
Jana Juvonen?
Well, let me very quickly on the issue of globalization. You know, that's a little harder to put it in the sort of world of school. But one issue, since Joyce mentioned, has to do with diversity that we're very intrigued about. We've been in Los Angeles studying the role of ethnic diversity. On one hand, you may think that when there's a lot of ethnic diversity in a school, you're going to get even more bullying that may be in part motivated by some sort of bias or self-preservation. But at the same time, what we are actually finding is that diversity can be protective. That is, when we find these really diverse, ethnically diverse schools where there's no one dominant ethnic group, but multiple groups about equal in size or relatively so, we get students reporting that they feel safer and they feel less bullied. And I think that's one of the ways in which we have to start doing this research is to find out more about these protective factors. In terms of social risk factors, I mean, other protective factors that decrease the risk factors for bullying is a presence of a friend. So we have to learn a little bit more about what makes a difference, what enables the bully or a victim cope better. And we know that when they feel socially supported, when their social dominance needs or their sense of vulnerability are met with somebody in the setting, everybody's better off.
That's a perfect place to end. Thank you to the three of you, Catherine Bradshaw, Jana Juvonen, and Joyce Heems. Catherine Bradshaw is a professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and School of Education. She is the deputy director of the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. Her studies include Bullies, Gangs, Drugs, and School, Understanding the Overlap and the Role of Ethnicity in Urbanicity, Risk Factors for Bullying Among Children with Autism and Spectrum Disorder, and Teachers and Education Support Professionals' Perspectives on Bullying and Prevention. Jana Juvonen is a professor of developmental psychology at UCLA. She is the author of Peer Harassment in School, The Plight of the Vulnerable and Victimized, and The Rejected and the Bullied, Lessons about Social Misfits from Developmental Psychology. Joyce Heems is chair and professor in the Department of Management and Industrial Relations at West Virginia University. Her publications include A Bully as an Archetypal Destructive Leader and Bullying from the Playground to the Boardroom. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.